Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, in addition to our informed, interesting, very, very great callers, we have some good research to talk
about. You betcha. Docs, they might talk the talk, but do they walk the walk when it comes to immunizations?
Doctors may not take their shots.
Well, we'll find out about it. And then we're going to talk about the glycemic index versus the high-fiber diet for patients with diabetes. And I think this is really important data, not just for diabetics, but for people who are trying to control their blood pressure, sort of the pre-diabetic people. Fascinating research. Really, what I think is breakthrough information about diabetes.
Mm-hmm. And a recipe.
Chicken tortilla soup with lime. If you love chicken, if you love tortillas, if you love lime, if you love spice, this is your recipe.
Okay, actually, it's your recipe, not from a listener, which means all of you who submitted recipes, your recipes were judged inadequate.
Either that is insulting.
Either not heart healthy enough or not tasty enough to make the cut.
Oh gosh, that is really that's just not the way it is.
And if you're angry about that, you can talk with Adam, who makes the judgment. 800-462-7413. Wait a minute, I'll give you his home number.
That's right. That's all his fault.
We have our medical mythbuster coming up later in the hour. Lots of good reasons to stay tuned here to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Let's welcome our first caller, Zorba, a listener with us now in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Well, hello, guys. How are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I got a sort of medical mystery going on with one of my friends. He moved up to Milwaukee a few months ago and recently had to move back to Florida, where he's originally from, because he's got very strange symptoms, and no one in the medical profession has really been able to help him as of yet. So,
what are those strange symptoms?
First of all, he seems to be allergic to cold. Whenever he puts ice to his skin, or even is out in the cold, with this cold wind or, you know, all this cold weather we get up here, his skin will, like, inflame up, and he'll get really itchy all over his whole body, and then he'll get very tired and get stomach pains and get dizzy and very odd things like that. And it all started when he felt this strange reactions to cold. So I'm hoping Zorba can at least point us in some kind of direction here with it. So
let me tell you what I think he has, and actually it's not terribly unusual. It's something called cold weather hives. Cold weather hives. We can get hives. He doesn't have full-blown hives, but you can get hives or that type of allergic reaction to a bunch of different things. It can be from viruses, they can be random, and they can be from literally cold weather. So people with severe cold weather hives, if they live in Florida and they walk into an air-conditioned spot, all of a sudden can break out in hives. Mm. Or they can feel sweaty, or they can feel uncomfortable, or they can feel itchy. And it can be a very, very problematic thing. Now, I've got a question. What has your friend taken? What's he been on? Has he been on any medications?
It was very strange. What he did was he took like Claritin, for example, and Tegament, and I think Zyrtec, and none of those things really did anything for him. They kind of relieved the itch a little bit, but what the strangest thing of all was is he would take these things for like a week, and they wouldn't do anything for him, so he stopped taking them. And then for like 2 or 3 days after he stopped taking them, he would get no symptoms whatsoever, and then they would come back after 3 days. So that was, to him, was the strangest thing, is he would take these medicines, and they wouldn't do anything while he's on them. I need to be off them, and for the first 2 or 3 days while he's off of them, he'd experience no symptoms.
Okay. I've got some very specific suggestions for him. This is what I recommend to your friend. Number one, every night for the next 2 to 4 weeks, he takes Benadryl, a generic Benadryl. They come in 25-milligram tablets. He takes 2 tablets at bedtime, and it'll make him a little sleepy. And if he can tolerate it during the day, he takes 25 milligrams twice a day during the day. So when he gets up, he takes 25 milligrams midday, another 25, and 50 at bedtime, 100 milligrams of Benadryl every day. It's the best antihistamine on the market. Some people don't tolerate the daytime dose. If that's the case, then he takes 1 Claritin when he gets up in the morning, and he takes 1 Claritin at noon, something like that. In other words, so he's on high-dose antihistamines. Number two, He should go to a doctor. He should get prednisone, and he should have a trial of prednisone. And I would recommend that he be on 20 to 40 milligrams of prednisone for a week, and then he taper down. Many, many people with this problem can do quite well on 3 to 5 milligrams a day of prednisone after they go through a burst, and that will often alleviate their symptoms so they can function. And the final thing is, if that fails, you add something called Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R, to the regime, and that may work. But he truly needs to be treated as cold weather hives. The treatment would go through an allergist or somebody who is really a subspecialist with hives. But he's got a hive problem. It's a variation of a hive problem, and he needs intensive therapy.
Yeah. I'm still confused on he's down in Florida now, right?
Yes, he born and raised in Florida, moved up here for 6 months, could not take the cold, couldn't take the weather, had to move back, and I've been missing him dearly ever since. I'm trying to find a way to get him back. So,
you want to get him back to Wisconsin? Why don't you just go down to Florida?
Milwaukee is too fun of a town to leave for me.
He doesn't want to go to Florida. Well, that's what it is. You know, you hang where you find the best time. There you go.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Zorba. And hopefully that'll do it for him. So,
thank you so much. We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. I'm biting my tongue on this. I'm from Milwaukee.
Yes.
Milwaukee is such a fun town.
Yes.
You can't stand it. I want to make a crack about that, but I dare not do it for fear of alienating all of the nice
Tom,
people in Milwaukee.
Tom, no, wait a second.
But you don't hear that sentence very often.
Wait a second. That's because, Tom, you're not in your 20s anymore, Tom. So you see, if you're in your 20s, you know, come on. You're in a town. You've got some good buds. You can go around, have a good time. Every town in America is a good town when you've got friends.
In that sense, Milwaukee is a really fun town. 800-462-7413. Toll free, 800-462-7413. To Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, we go. Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I have a question about smoking and asthma. Mm-hmm. And I know this is Dr. Zorba's specialty, and I have kind of a... Oh, it's weird to me. I'm in the process of my second and hopefully my last serious attempt to quit smoking. I'm on the second month, and I've been using the Chantix, and it's helped tremendously. And this happened the last time I quit smoking, and it's happening again now, where my asthma symptoms come back full force and stronger than they were when I was smoking.
Really?
Yeah, and I'm having, it's the kind of, not tightness of the chest, but where you would have a low peak flow meter rating, if that makes sense, like when you blow out and you can't get your air out very well.
Sure, the peak flow meter, for those of us who are not asthmatics or doctors, is how much air can you blow out suddenly. You take this little machine. It's not a machine. It's a little contraption that measures it, and you see how quickly you can blow. And people with asthma can't get rid of the air in the lungs as quickly because they're wheezing. Well, first of all, congratulations. You're 2 months into getting rid of the smoking, and you got to kick the habit. So you have to stick with it. That's number one. That's number one. But I've heard this from other people where they'll say, you know, I'm an asthmatic, and I have finally quit smoking, and my asthma appeared to get worse. And it's sort of an interesting phenomena that people seem to have. And I don't know if their asthma gets worse or they're just noticing it more because their asthma was better. In other words, you know, their asthma, what they're doing is comparing what life is like not smoking with life like smoking. Yeah. And instead of just being bad all the time, it's intermittently bad. And so, you know, before that, you kind of accepted it, but now you don't. But let me tell you what I suggest. First of all, stick to the Advair. Advair is a great medication. It's a combination steroid and another drug that decreases sort of the muscle spasm in the lungs, and you've got to stick with that. It's crucial to keep you on track. Don't give up your smoking and, you know, your smoking cessation with Chantix. Stay on the asthma medications and don't give up. You can conquer this habit. So I want to congratulate you on going this far, and you've got to go, as we say, the whole nine yards.
I really don't ever want to quit again. I want this to be the last time.
Look, I'm a smoker. I mean, I used to smoke. I'm sort of a recovering smoker. I haven't smoked for 35 years. I mean, I smoked in college. And the reality is you're always a recovering smoker. You can always go back, and you got to be careful. You have to be careful. So, good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Now, will the asthma improve as the distance from the smoking life gets longer?
Absolutely, absolutely. And like I said, what happens is I think when you're, I was talking about this to a doctor friend of mine the other day, talking about how 20 years ago when we switched offices, we had an ashtray in the waiting room of our doctor's office. I mean, how stupid could you be? We had that right in the waiting room. And the reality is years ago, everyone smoked around. So you hardly noticed when somebody smoked when they walked into a room because there was sort of the tobacco smell all over. Now, if somebody is outside and you walk by them, you can often smell the smoke on their clothing. So when you stop smoking, you begin to notice how bad your asthma is often because it was that bad, but it was that bad all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think she's picking up intermittently bad asthma when before that it was commonly and chronically bad asthma.
Yeah. Well, talking about doctors, they say everybody should get flu shots. But maybe the docs themselves aren't following their own advice?
Now, are you questioning whether or not doctors talk the talk but don't walk the walk?
I guess I am questioning. I guess this information we have questions that.
Yeah, this study actually shows that. A significant chunk of healthcare professionals, so those are not just doctors. They're doctors, nurses, and others, declined to get vaccinated against the flu season this last year. Only about 40% actually opted to get vaccinated during the 2007-2008 season.
60% of healthcare professionals don't get the flu shot?
Abysmal.
These are the people whose job it is to have people come in when they have the flu help these people deal with these people?
Right. These are people who are coming to contact with people who have the flu. 60% of them essentially did not get vaccinated. Only 40% got vaccinated.
Well, do we have any idea how that compares with the general population? How many of us
I think we have a lot of issues here. I mean, we have the general population, and I'm not sure what that number is, but the general population doesn't see 25 or 30 sick people a day during the flu season and spread it. And this is really abysmal. This is not the right way to go at all. If you look at it, doctors, healthcare professionals, nurses, medical assistants, they should all be vaccinated because they're going to spread it. And if they're not being vaccinated, I mean, why aren't they being vaccinated? Well, and then you ask them and you get all kinds of excuses. Well, I'll get the shot tomorrow. It's like everybody else. You know, I don't want to have the pain. Maybe I don't need the shot. The reality is they're lazy and slothful, and they're just not getting it for whatever reason.
I think maybe some doctors, maybe a lot of doctors, you would know this far better than I, still believe that they're some kind of superhuman being, that they really aren't affected by the same things that affect the general population.
Sure, I'm not going to get sick. I'm a doctor. I don't need the flu shot because I haven't gotten sick in a while. Well, let me tell you this. About 12 years ago, I had a shot, and the shots are only 85% effective. And I got influenza. I took the shot nice and early, and the season was a long season, and I got influenza at the end of the season. And you know what? It wasn't good.
Wow.
It sucked.
Well, now, did that make you say to yourself, why did I bother to get this flu shot? I'm not going to even get it next year because I get the flu anyway?
No, I was smarter when I got my shot. I didn't say it didn't make a difference because the reality is it still has an 85% chance that it's going to protect me. And so, it might have been worse.
So here's a situation where I, as a patient, would probably be wise to the next time I go to see my doctor to say to the doctor, by the way, doc, have you gotten your flu shot
yet? That's a great idea. I love it.
You're always telling me, quit doing this, quit doing that, start doing this.
How's your health?
Yeah, right.
What are you doing to keep yourself healthy? I love it.
800-462-7413. It's toll free. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, a caller with us now in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
I have a question about my aging brain. I am recently retired, baby boomer, and recently took a part-time job in a completely different field. And I found that it took me longer to catch on to the computer software and the policies and everything. And I'm just curious about my brain and the aging process. And is it, am I getting feeble-minded or am I just slow? Or is it just that I haven't lived with computers all my life?
Well, let me ask, how old are you?
I'm 61.
Oh, well, it's all over.
It's all over. It's all over. That's it. Pack up your bags and go visit the Undertaker. It's time to go 6 feet under. You'll be a babbling idiot before long. Yeah, well, you know, that's a couple different things, by the way. Are you a computer native or a computer immigrant?
I'm an immigrant.
That's a big issue. That's a big issue. Computer native is somebody who's learned about computers when they were a teenager, basically, up until about the age of 15 or 16. Now, I happen to be a computer native. When I lived in Chicago, I went to the Illinois Institute of Technology for 10 classes when I was in high school with a bunch of my other nerdy friends. Mm. And we learned about computers. And I love them, and I'm an immigrant.
I never knew that about you.
Yeah, I'm a nerd.
They had computers that long ago.
That's very good. You will get yours by the end of this show. Believe me, this will come back to haunt you, Tom Clark. This will come back. You will get your due. That's your due, Mr. Abacus Man. But computer immigrants are ones that grow up and they know how stupid they are. Computers are the dumbest machines on earth. They can't figure anything out without a human being. Now, computer natives believe that. Now, computer immigrants believe computers are smart and they're dumb. And they go, well, I just couldn't figure out what the computer wanted to do. No, no, no. The computer couldn't figure out what you wanted to do. Computers are dumber than you. They're like a piece of paper. That's all they are. Now, here's the issue. Because you're an immigrant, you have to work harder because you don't have the language or the tools. And so you have to spend more time and you will ask more questions. And often now, were you trained with this with a trainer, this new software?
No. Basically, here's what you do, 1, 2, 3, and then, you know, then I'd have to do it.
And how old was the person who taught you?
In their 20s.
That's the problem. Uh-huh. So what you have to do is you have to say, and this is something that you need on your job, right?
Oh, yes. Okay. It's a big part of the job.
Here's what you do. I'll give you exactly what you do. You say, I want to be trained. I need an hour of training. And then I want a second training period for another hour a week or 2 weeks later. That's what you do.
Uh-huh.
That's what you do. You insist either directly with your employer or your supervisor that you need training. And don't ever say, I'm too dumb. I need training. Don't say that. I need training. Period. That's all. Don't think it's short-term memory. If you had a memory dysfunction, you would never learn it. It is not short-term memory. It's a training issue.
Okay.
They're not training you the right way. They're speaking in geek, and you only understand English. That's literally what's going on.
Yep.
That's literally what's going on. You are
so much better.
That's all it is. That's our job. Tom's job and my job is to make you feel better. It's just like Thomas Jefferson said about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Enjoy your day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. That was really great advice, I think. And that's right. 20-somethings don't understand how someone who isn't used to computers.
They're natives. They're computer natives.
Yeah.
No, that's exactly what it is. Whereas immigrants take a bit, it's a training issue. It's not an intelligence issue. Some people have,
right.
You know, hey, don't you have it? Some people read it from start to finish and other people sort of scan. We learn it different methods. The problem with computers is the geeks pick it up right away and they think you can pick it up in 15 minutes.
Yep.
Some can, some can't.
Well, Zorba, loosen your tongue now and get your brain ready because it's time for another edition of Rapid Fire with questions from our Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox.
Woohoo!
Here we go. Scott from Milwaukee, Wisconsin leads us off. Wants to know, is less oxygen available in winter because there are fewer plants? And if so, could it cause drowsiness?
Not at all. You're drowsy in the wintertime because the nights are long, the days are short, and maybe you're drinking too much.
Let's stay on the topic and move just west to Madison, Wisconsin, where Selma would like to know if her drop in serotonin levels due to the turn of the season is causing a craving for sweets.
Yes.
Why?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? That I can't answer, but yes. I think serotonin and sweets are intimately locked together because we know that people who eat lots of chocolate have a boost in their serotonin level. In the wintertime, it's often dark. Our serotonin drops. We get the blahs. My recommendation is a nice piece of dark chocolate every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Peace, not a bar.
JC from Folkestone, Georgia, was recently diagnosed with high cholesterol. His doc gave him a list of good and bad foods. Olive oil was on the good list, but olives were on the foods to avoid list. Can you clarify?
Not at all. I can't figure out why they would do it. Olives and olive oil. Hey, what's in olive oil but olives that have been pressed? So I put olives on the good list along with olive oil.
Speaking of recommending foods, new nursing mother Mary Joy is wondering if you could recommend a few foods besides oatmeal that promote lactation production.
Milk. Milk promotes lactation production very well. And in Wisconsin, we always promote milk as nature's best food.
Time is up for this round of Rapid Fire, but get your question in for our next edition by sending us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. We have lots more interesting research, more of your calls, and our medical myth buster. Stay with us here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. Recipe time now, then we're back to your calls. The recipe for chicken tortilla soup with lime, and it smells pretty good. We're going to taste it, and you'll taste it after you get the recipe and put it together yourself.
Well,
but right now, here comes the recipe.
I think they can smell it over the air, don't
you?
You
do.
Yeah, well, I mean, think chicken. Can you smell chicken when you think about it?
No,
obviously. Yeah. Well, we're not going to get you to think chicken. Now, one of the things I happen to love is I love chicken. I love spice. I love the taste of lime and tortilla soup. Really, I've made tortilla, different types of tortilla soup through the years with my family. And the nice thing about tortilla soup with chicken and lime is often children will eat it in the house. I mean, it's really good. My kids really have loved tortilla soup over the years, and there are a whole bunch of different recipes.
Tortilla soup is always good. I've never had bad tortilla soup.
No, I mean, it's one of those things. Okay, so let's start out. We're going to talk about the strips that you put in the soup and the soup itself, and then how to make things even more heart healthy. Mm-hmm. So start out with four small corn tortillas.
Four small corn tortillas.
That's right. They've got to be corn. The flour will not work here. They won't stand up. Mm-hmm. 3 teaspoons of olive oil.
3 little tea olive oil.
And we'll tell you how to use that. And you're going to have some – a variation on this is going to be olive oil non-stick cooking spray.
Okay.
So you should have a can of that around.
Well, can't you just buy those strips in a store?
You can buy the tortillas in the store. You mean tortillas pre-stripped?
Yeah.
No, they tend to be more oily. They're made with oil.
Oh, so you can't.
They're basically deep fried. So it's like buying chips.
Okay.
The answer is yes, you can buy them, but they're not healthy.
Oh.
They're not healthy.
Okay.
Now, there may be a baked chip out there, but I've never seen that. For the soup, 1 clove of garlic pressed.
A clove of garlic pressed.
1 cup of chopped onions.
Cup of chopped onions.
1 zucchini diced.
A zucchini diced.
Okay. 6 cups of low-sodium chicken broth.
6 cups low-sodium chicken broth.
Okay, so let's talk about low-sodium versus regular chicken broth. Regular chicken broth is fine. A lot of sodium in it. I recently went to a conference that talked about sodium and its relationship to blood pressure. And the newest data seems to show that the older you get, the more salt-sensitive you are. In other words, if your blood pressure is higher, it may be because you just have too much sodium. And the average American gets about 3.5 to 4.5 grams of sodium. That's a lot of sodium. And we only need about 2.5 grams. So wherever you can cut it, cut it. And chicken broth, often you don't need it. So low sodium, 6 cups of low sodium chicken broth.
Okay.
A tomato diced.
A tomato diced.
A tablespoonful of diced jalapeno.
1 big tea diced jalapeno.
Now, you like hot food, right?
I do.
So you might even use 2.
I might.
Might even use 2. A bay leaf.
A bay leaf.
A 1/2 teaspoon of cumin.
half a little tea, cumin.
Now, when you buy cumin, I always recommend either an Asian or a Mexican grocery store, and the reason is the cumin there is cheap. When you buy cumin in a typical store, for whatever reason, that particular spice is often 2 to 3 times what you will pay in a small Mexican grocery store. 1/8 a teaspoon of dried crushed red pepper.
An 1/8 little tea dried crushed red pepper.
You know, those pepper flakes that you put on pizza would be just fine, too.
Pepper flakes would be on pizza.
I usually have about 4 or 5 different kinds of peppers around the house. I usually have chipotle pepper, and it's wonderful. They all add smoked pepper. They all add a little different taste to it. 12 ounces of rotisserie chicken shredded.
12 ounces of rotisserie chicken shredded.
Now, why do we use rotisserie chicken shredded? Ask me the question. Go ahead.
Why do we use rotisserie chicken shredded?
I knew I could get you to say this. Because it tastes better. You know, white meat often can be dried out. You can use boneless skinless chicken breast that you make, but there's something about rotisserie chicken, and the answer is it's got that chicken fat that's sort of mixed in with the flavor and the spice, and it's just a much better taste. 2 green onions sliced.
2 green onions sliced.
1/4 cup of fresh cilantro. If you like cilantro, there are likers and dislikers of cilantro.
Okay, 1/4 cup of it if you like it.
And 2 tablespoonfuls of fresh lime juice.
2 big tea fresh lime juice. I have a question.
Yes.
Can I leave the zucchini out?
Of course, you can do whatever you want to. This is
America. Put some other thing in there. What would I put in it? I don't like zucchini.
Well, you could do a few things. First of all, I've had tortilla soup with beans. If you like canned beans, you could use a can of beans instead. And you would wash the beans. You don't just put them right from the can. Yeah. Usually I wash them because they have a better sort of a flavor to them.
Yeah.
You could put in a package of frozen spinach.
Oh.
Frozen spinach is great.
Oh,
in
yeah,
soup.
It's
cheap.
Spinach.
It's inexpensive.
Tastes
it's
good,
80 to 90 cents package of frozen spinach.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so preheat the oven, 350 degrees. We're going to make the tortilla strips. Okay, so preheat the oven to 350. Brush the tortillas with 2 teaspoons of olive oil. Cut them in half. Stack the halves. Cut them crosswise. So you're making little strips. Place the strips on a baking sheet and bake until golden brown, about 12 to 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a variation of this is where you don't have to brush it is you spray it. You buy the olive oil nonstick spray and you basically put these little strips that you cut them, put them on there and spray it. Either way works. Either way is a low-fat way of making a strip that is not fried. One you buy in the store, inevitably they're fried. Stay away from it. Okay, the soup. In a large saucepan, heat the remaining oil that's there. Saute the garlic, onions and zucchini, then add the broth, then add the diced tomatoes, jalapenos, bay leaf, cumin, and the red pepper. Bring it to a boil. Reduce the heat. Simmer for about 5 minutes. Add the chicken and simmer until cooked through. Stir in the green onions, cilantro, and lime juice. Season with salt and pepper to taste. For the most part, let the people who are eating this with you salt and pepper to their liking. There'll be less salt in there.
Mm-hmm.
Garnish with the tortilla strips and serve. Bon appetit. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. It's 218 calories for each recipe. And Tom is now going to try it and tell us what it tastes like.
I'm working around the zucchini here.
You're working around the zucchini, and here it goes. And Tom is going to tell us what it's like. How does it taste?
It's very good.
It's very good. So Tom says it's very good. I'm going to taste it, and I'm going to tell you what I think it is like. It's delicious.
Yeah.
I love this.
It sat here and got a little cool while we were doing it.
But there's always a complainer in every room.
I think, Adam, we need
it's
you,
too
you,
hot
we need
it's
you
too
to
cold.
Come rushing through the door with the hot item right as we're ready to eat rather than bringing it in before we do the recipe.
And a cold beer.
Oh, yeah. Beer would be great with this.
If you want a copy of our recipe, why don't you come to our website, zorbapastor.org, and you can look at our archives, plus you can sign up for our weekly podcast.
Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. We have some callers waiting, but a line is open now for you if you have a question for Zorba. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener in Boise, Idaho. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I've got a problem. I guess my wife has a problem. This started about 5 to 7 years ago, and every time we get done with the evening meal, whether we are eating at home or out, About 10 to 15 minutes after she gets done with the meal, she goes into a sneezing fit. And usually this is going to be one sneeze after another, anywhere from 12 up to probably about two dozen sneezes.
Oh, my goodness.
It's quite embarrassing when you're out at dinner.
She's had this situation all her life?
No, just about the last five years and everything. I was going to say it only happens, Tom, in the evening meal. It doesn't happen if we have lunch together or in the morning, but only in the evening meal.
How long have you been married?
I've been married 32 years.
Oh, I was going to say, if it's been 5 years, then you're the cause. But you've been around during the pre-sneezing part of her life, too.
Oh, I might have changed my cologne. I don't think that did it.
Changed my cologne. You know, Tom is always looking for an opening to discuss these marital issues. That's exactly it. Always looking for an opening. So is your wife, what is she eliminated from what she's eating? I mean, as this occurs when she drinks wine or alcohol?
Well, that's interesting because we usually do have like a cocktail before dinner, mm-hmm. or maybe some wine with dinner. Yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's interesting. This is this activates a similar system to the allergy system. She may be allergic to something in the meal. She may not be allergic, but often if we eliminate one or two things, we can see whether or not that's the issue. So my first recommendation is she become a teetotaler and see if that's it. The second issue is pepper. Mm-hmm. You want to see if any sort of pepper is the issue. So you want to choose a restaurant that is not a Mexican restaurant that may have hot and spicy food. You want to eat bland food when you go out and just see whether or not pepper is an issue. Those would be kind of the two things. Tom is smiling at me when I said
You want to eliminate pepper from the diet?
Well, you want to see if pepper is an issue.
Eating food without pepper?
Yeah, that's exactly.
I'd rather sneeze all the time than have to eat food without pepper.
When I said no pepper, you could just see, you can't see it, but his jaw kind of dropped and he started to sweat because he just could imagine what life would be like with it. But that's what I would look at. Now, if that fails, the other issue when she goes out is an aspirin and Zantac, over-the-counter Zantac, 300 milligrams before she eats, an hour before she eats, may stop this response from happening. And if that fails, you add a drug called Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R. Now, these are not things you would do at home, but these are things that you would do when you go out, because I know what you mean. It is disturbing, and people then go, well, is there something wrong? I mean, that's the disturbing part.
That's,
you know.
Yeah, that has concerns. Is this not uncommon?
Well, as you can tell, I'm giving you advice, and it didn't stump me, so it's more common than you think.
We've had other – I think isn't there some sort of coordination between the eating and the olfactory?
Yes, people
have stuffed noses after they're eating.
Yeah, and public radio people are just more aware of that than the general public. The people who listen to Rush Limbaugh don't care if they sneeze. Who listen to public radio do. It's very obvious. There are differences in the culture.
If you have gross in the ears, then you're gross.
You don't care. Yeah, That's exactly it. And we could really parse that out even more, but let's leave it at sneezing.
Yeah.
So try these things and call us back.
Well, very fine. Thank you for the advice.
Thanks a lot for the call at 800-462-7413. Before we break, you have to sit before the court for another edition of Judge Zorba. Today's case comes to us from Linda, who is a yoga instructor, having a discussion with her students about where an inhaled breath goes first in the body. She writes, "Several of my students have brought up the fact that they always thought the breath comes into the belly first when we inhale. When I ask people to breathe into their body, I am imagining that the breath is going into the chest, into the ribs, and then into the belly area. And when we exhale, it begins with the abdominal muscles going in, the ribs coming down, and then the chest relaxing."
Well, first of all, when you breathe in, your air goes into your lungs. Your lungs are in your chest, period. Everything below the chest and below the diaphragm is your belly. You actually don't have air going into your belly. Now, From a breathing point of view, we can use our intercostal muscles, which are the muscles in the ribs in the chest. We can use our diaphragm for diaphragmatic breathing. When we use our diaphragm, which is sort of our deep breathing, we often relax and flex our abdominal muscles because that's one of the ways that we move our diaphragm. You know, we take a deep breath in, our chest is moving up, and often we contract our abdominal muscles. So we have this feeling that it's going deep into our body, a visual feeling that you get with yoga. And that's a wonderful feeling. It makes us feel, and it has to partially to do with the relaxation response and partially to do with endorphins in our body. But it goes into our lungs. Our lungs are in our chest. It doesn't really go into the belly. It's just a visualization.
Aha. Uh-huh. If you have a case for the next installment of Judge Zorba, send it to the show in an email to
Zorba at WPR.org.
That research coming up, more of your calls, are a medical myth buster as well. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, if you have a question for Zorba, 1-800-462-7413. But Zorba, before we get back to the phones, you have some recent research on diet for diabetics.
That's right. Something called the glycemic index, concept that came out a few years ago, that basically refined sugars, as a perfect example of something that it will produce blood sugar very quickly in your bloodstream, are not as good for you as essentially foods that have what we call a low glycemic index, which will take a little while before the blood sugar will sort of be elevated. Mm-hmm. So a good example would be, you may have 100 calories of Coca-Cola and you have 100 calories of beans, which is going to raise your blood sugar quicker, sooner. It's obviously the Coca-Cola because it's absorbed into the body. Uh-huh. So the issue all along has been, how does this really affect your diabetes if you're eating the same amount of carbohydrate? Got it? So it's exactly the same amount of carbohydrate, maybe 100 grams of carbohydrate. One is a low glycemic index. One is a high glycemic index. Which one is going to be better? And basically, diabetics who are eating foods that have a low glycemic index have an improvement in their diabetes, irregardless of how much they actually eat. So let me give you some good examples of foods with low glycemic index. Beans, peas, lentils, nuts, pasta, and then certain breads, pumpernickel, rye, pita, flaxseed, certain breakfast cereals, large flake oatmeal, big oatmeal flakes, and oat bran. So those are good examples of low glycemic foods. Now, if we look at high glycemic foods, that would be something like Cocoa Crisps. In terms of a cereal, it would be a sugary drink, something such as sugary drink, something such as a sweet apple. That would be something.
Well, I'm not diabetic, but it seems to me that if I were diabetic, I probably would know this already.
Not at all, because it's really new stuff. Now, what they did with the study, though, they compared glycemic index to high fiber. And generally, for diabetics, we tell you high fiber is what counts. Forget the glycemic index. And the whole thing can be confusing. What they found was that the people who were paying attention to the glycemic index did far, far better than the people who were paying attention to fiber, for both cholesterol and blood sugar. So the bottom line is, it's not just fiber, it's fiber and glycemic index. And the medical profession has actually not embraced the glycemic index concept as much as people out there who are actually diabetic.
So fiber doesn't count?
No, fiber counts, but it's secondary to glycemic index. In other words, it's the minor player when it comes to blood sugar. The major player is how quickly, basically, do the sugars absorb into the body. So if you go to our website at zorbapastor.org, we will give you a list of the low and high glycemic index foods. Pay attention and then eat right.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener now, Zorba, in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
I have a nutritional question. And it's sort of a debate in my family, so I'm really hoping I can get down to the bottom of this with you guys.
Okay.
Okay. It has to do with organic versus inorganic food. Is there any nutritional benefit to eating organic versus non-organic food?
Well, who's that with you?
Oh, that's our female hyacinth macaw. I'm a zookeeper, and I'm at work.
You're a zookeeper. You're worth it. I was listening to the sound, and I thought, I don't think that's a baby there.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. So what can the macaw tell us?
The macaw is saying, get away. I'm being territorial. Who's that on the phone with you right now?
The macaw is trying to scare you away.
So yeah, very. They can do that very well.
So the question is organic versus regular. Is that it?
Yes.
And which side are you on?
I'm kind of stuck in the middle because I can see both sides, except for the nutritional part of it. I've tried looking up data for it. And also, that was kind of a part B of my question. Are there any good studies done or any conclusive studies done that show, nutritionally speaking, if there are any benefits to organic versus inorganic food?
Well, this has been a big issue for a long time. First of all, if we're looking at vitamins, minerals, flavonoids, carotenoids, things called phytochemicals, we know, for instance, that freshness is a big issue. So organic or inorganic, the freshness is the issue that counts a lot. So, for instance, we know there's a difference in the sugar content of fruit that's grown on a tree and is allowed to ripen, but to be able to get it to the marketplace so we can eat it off and it's picked earlier, and then it ripens in the box. We know there are differences there. Organic or inorganic do not matter. It's basically how well it's preserved. We also know that a lot of foods that are frozen quickly, fruits and vegetables that are frozen quickly, may have more vitamins and minerals in them, especially vitamins, than a produce that is, quote, fresh, but really isn't fresh. You know, it's basically been mm-hmm. sitting on the shelf, mm-hmm. We'll say, for 5 days to a week. Now, from an organic point of view, the jury is still out. There are a lot of people who believe that organic food is better because basically it doesn't have the chemicals that are grown mm-hmm. in organic food. Mm-hmm. So it's really not a nutritional point of view. It's a point of view of we don't have the insecticides, we don't have the pesticides, we think it's safer. And that's a very, very viable argument. And so for people who pay that extra money for organic food, they're really paying not to get the extra junk that's used in growing the food itself. So it's really not a nutritional issue, it's more of a toxin issue.
Mm. And are those toxins, have they been shown to be a problem?
Well, it depends on who you read. You know, it depends on who you read. We know that cancer is in the environment. We know that for sure. There's no doubt about it. We're getting environmental carcinogens. And the question is, are these carcinogens coming through the food supply? Well, we know, for instance, that every few years the FDA takes an insecticide off the market, right? And so that insecticide is bad. That's why they take it off the market. Now, do those insecticides get into the food system? Well, we had the ALR scare years ago that was associated with apples. So ALR was no longer used on apples and whether or not apple juice concentrated it. So I think it's a viable argument that pesticides can indeed be a problem in the food supply. But is it a real argument? Well, once again, this is controversial. So for many people, they pay more for organic food because they want to stay on the right side of that argument. They want to say, look, it's not been proven. On the other hand, I want to make sure that I stay away from as many carcinogens as I can. I think that's very viable. If we look at the number one carcinogen in our environment, it's tobacco.
Right.
Tobacco. We've got to look at it that way.
Yeah, stay away from that, definitely.
Stay away. And then if we look at the way to keep cancer from happening, it's really 7 servings of fruits and veggies a day. A serving is a fistful. And most Americans get 3 to 5 servings a day, and 20% of all the vegetables consumed in the United States of America happen to be the French fry.
Really?
Yes, and the French fry is not your ideal vegetable.
Right.
Now, the potato is good, but the fry attached to the potato, the oil, is really what sinks us, makes us obese, and is not good for us. So so if you're going to do organic, that's fine. Do the right organics and don't fry your potatoes. I mean, if you follow what I mean, there's a lot of misconnect here. People will go eat French fries, and then they'll say, but I eat organic food.
Okay, well, the debate, I suppose, will keep raging in my family, but this definitely helps.
Good.
Very good. And now, do you feed the macaw organic food or not?
You know, if we could afford it, I'm sure the curators would love it. But
what's the macaw's name?
Well, we have a pair right now. These are hyacinth macaws, and the male is Patty, and the female is Sadie.
Cool.
Can either one of them say I'm a pretty boy or something?
Yeah, they can actually say a lot of things, but it's when they choose to say it. We don't use them for shows. We let them be naturalistic, so they'll breathe.
Well, thank them for not saying naughty words while we were doing our conversation.
As soon as we hang up.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster now. We have a listener myth today from John in Waterloo, Illinois. John's myth buster deals with one of our favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health topics, poison ivy. He writes, "My capping friend Paul said, if you eat the leaf of poison ivy, you will not break out with a rash the next time you come in contact." I love this. Is there any truth to this myth?
100% no.
Who would think that?
Well, let me tell you something. That is a very, very common myth.
Go away.
Very, very common myth. That myth is very, very common. When poison ivy season strikes in my office in Wisconsin, at least once a year or twice a year, people come in and ask me if I eat the leaves.
I'd be immune from it.
That myth is still wrong. That's right. That's right there. And there used to be a potion called Ivyol, Ivyol or ALL, many, many years ago when I first started practice, and people used to drink a poison ivy extract mix in an attempt to basically improve their poison ivy. And then the FDA said, no, this has never been proven to be safe and effective, and put it on the market. So no, the answer is myth, do not eat those leaves because you will become sick and you will not become immune to poison ivy.
And before you eat anything, see if Zorba can bust your myth. Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener, joins in now from West Union, Iowa. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I have celiac disease, and I also have a low thyroid.
What is celiac disease?
Celiac disease is an autoimmune disorder where you cannot digest the gluten found in wheat, rye, barley, and most oats.
Thank you. Zorba, of course, knows that, but I did not. So go ahead.
And so I also have the low thyroid. And on my online support group, there's a woman on there that tells me to stay away from soy. Well, I'm also lactose intolerant, which means I have to have soy milk. So I've never found anything online other than very biased papers stay away from soy.
Right. And well, first of all, let's keep track of what you can actually talk about on the web. And the answer is you can talk about anything you want to on the web. That's what you can do.
Yeah.
So you can write down, let's stay away from soy milk, let's stay away from the sun, and let's stay away from the moonbeams, because moonbeams will cause, you can say anything you want to, and it only costs you $2.50 to $5 a month to host that website. So garbage in, garbage out. That's what I tell people. Now, if you're looking for scientific evidence, and there's a lot of science behind celiac disease, it is an autoimmune disease, and you have an inability to basically digest, as you said, wheat, rice, barley. There's certain things you can digest, and it's relative. Some people have a severe case. Some people have a mild case. I've never seen anything about soy. So basically, ignore the advice. It doesn't hold water. Now, some people are also soy intolerant, but it's not due to celiac disease from what I know of celiac disease. They're just also soy intolerant. Some people are intolerant of, you know, multiple foods. So you've had soy and not had any problem?
Right.
Well, the answer is you're just okay and you can eat all the soy that you want to. You would know it. You know what happens when you eat wheat, right?
Right.
I mean, don't you get pain and discomfort?
My migraine headaches.
Yeah, your migraine headaches. So a couple of questions. How long did it take you to take them to figure out you had celiac disease? It is not an easy diagnosis to make unless
Over
you think
years.
About it.
20 years.
Very common. You can often, a blood test will often now diagnose this, and if that doesn't work, you need a biopsy. And the issue now is that there may be more gluten intolerance than we think, and that people who have stomach pains on and off actually have this gluten intolerance, and before the blood test, it was only by biopsy, and that's kind of a big deal to get biopsied. And the fascinating thing is wheat, as you know, is in everything when you look in prepared products, right?
Right.
So anyway, getting back to the soy, enjoy it. Have all the soy milk you want to.
So that doesn't affect the thyroid then?
I don't think it affects the thyroid at all. Doesn't affect the gluten, does not affect the thyroid. No. Enjoy
it. Okay. Cool. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. Before we leave for the week, Zorba, let's see if we can help out Ginny in College Station, Texas. Ginny writes, do you know of a deodorant that works for sensitive skin but doesn't cause permanent dark staining on clothes? I'm a redhead with very sensitive skin, so finding a workable deodorant has been an issue for years.
Well, there are a couple of issues. First of all, there is deodorant, which basically is a perfume, and there's antiperspirant, which is made of aluminum compounds. And they're different. Most deodorant sold in America today is a deodorant and an antiperspirant. Mm-hmm. And for some people, they are very sensitive to the antiperspirant and not the deodorant. So my recommendation is initially get a pure deodorant, see if that works. That might be enough. If you actually sweat too much, you're going to sweat through
it. Pure deodorant doesn't work as well as far as...
Does not work as well, but for some people, that's all they need. They don't really need an antiperspirant. Okay. And if not, what you want to go to the cosmetic counselor and then speak to basically the cosmetologist. And my mother used to be a cosmetologist, and they know exactly which deodorants basically will have less aluminum compound in them, and that's what you want to look for. And they are on the market, and I can't tell you which ones they are, but if you go
can.
Literally...
You're a practicing family physician, and you can't tell us?
Tell you where they are, and my mom died in 1981, so she couldn't tell you either.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, there are ones, and there are ones that are also by mainline expensive pharmaceutical houses, or rather cosmetic houses, such as Clinique. And Clinique will often have a deodorant that is basically an aluminum-type deodorant that has very little aluminum compound in it. So deodorant first, antiperspirant second, mm-hmm. and good luck.
And if you have a lifestyle issue staining your life, let us help by sending us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7411. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Charles Monroe Kane plays the part of our executive producer. And our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0110Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.